Okay, welcome back to another episode of Just Another Bozo on the Bus. I'm your host, Paul Randack, and I'm here with my friend, dear friend and colleague, Brett Heiner. Hi, Brett.
Hello, Paul.
Welcome back.
And hello.
Yeah. Welcome back to the Bozo Station. Nice. Just Another Bozo on the Bus. Welcome all my Bozo friends out there. I'm glad you're listening today. Brett and I have been trying to get together for the past month or so. To kind of touch base again, those of you that may have listened to one of the original Bozo podcasts, kind of broke that down into two, but I don't do that anymore if they're long. I just keep it as one. Couple quick notes. Next week, we have Rebecca Holt here, who will be doing the sound weaving and talking about her life, which is a fascinating story, and how she got to where she is today. The next weekend will be the Bozo Roundtable with Brent, Sarah, oh my gosh, Brady, and I'm not sure about Matt. And then the following week, we're welcoming Dr. Robert Simpson, who's an MD, an addictionologist, I believe, mm-hmm. here, who I sat down with yesterday. Brett and I visited with him for a while. Fascinating man, amazing story, and hope you guys will tune in for that. That'll be, I think, on the 20th.
Yeah, so that was fun yesterday.
Yeah, that was fun. That was good. And that kind of gets us close to the end of the month. I think I've got, I can't remember who's on the 27th, but anyway, we've got the next 6 weeks of programming lined up. Anyway, excuse me. All right. So Brett and I are going to kind of do our own little round table here today. We have a couple of areas we want to talk about and things we want to discuss, especially things that are important to us when it comes to family systems and different forms of treatment and the importance of experiential or depth or eco-psychology and those kinds of things. Share our thoughts and feelings about those and the importance of it. But I think we'll start off with family systems today and talk a mm-hmm. little bit about that, because I know that's important to both of us. And mm-hmm. for over three years, I was leading up, or at least co-leading the family program at Wasatch with Dave Whitaker. My responsibilities have changed in the last little bit, but you and I did... Mm-hmm. Well, we did family programming together in family groups for, I don't know, 10 years prior to to that time. So yeah. we got some background.
We got some background
with that. Anyway.
And did a lot of research. And when you were looking at the Sonoma Center, there was a lot of research. You know, what material did we want to, you know, bring in? You know, how much was the family going to... be participating, you know, with an individual's recovery, and
which is always a question,
right?
Yeah, how much? One, do they want to be right? Mm-hmm. Do they want to participate, mm-hmm. Or do they just want, you know, the person to be fixed and then come back? You know?
Right.
Just send him back when he's all ready and all shiny and fixed up and ready to go.
Right. And that's going to be there. Most family members. They've got their own system set up, and then when you have someone that's stepping out of that norm, uh-huh. which is crucial to one's development, right?
Yeah.
Is to find themselves, to individuate,
mm-hmm.
and with family members, they have their norms, they have their systems, and then someone's acting out against it. There's this idea of pulling them back into it instead of working with them and adjusting the system, you know, in a way that works for everyone, and not to support the dysfunction, but really to recreate a new system as it changes and evolves. And so I think most family members are on this, you know, they're holding the problem, if that's it. You know, I don't, not that they're the problem, but they're causing the dysfunction or the conflict. And here at Lighthouse, we have a family recovery group every Thursday. And we've changed and evolved into, it really is a family recovery group. Mm-hmm. It's not, although we cover some of the aspects of addiction and some of the symptoms with it, It's really, where are you? You know, as a family member, a mother, a father, a wife, husband, where are you, and how are you holding on to yourself? A lot of times we find that whatever we project out onto the person that is struggling, if we could pull that back, it's something in our life that...
Right. You're looking at this from the systemic model, I'm
absolutely
guessing.
Right.
When I look back over my experiences with family programming, family systems, it was actually, you had a big influence on me adapting to the family model, even before I came a marriage and family therapist, mm-hmm. and got a lot of education about cybernetics and family systems and systemic theory. I remember it kind of began to open up to me when, from the interventions back in the, mm-hmm. when you had that for following that model, and that goes back to the Institute of Change and In Care and those, mm-hmm. those times when, I remember you meeting with the families and working to get the family healthy, mm-hmm. even before we addressed the problems that were associated with the IP or the identified
right.
patient or identified problem, if you
yeah,
will.
Yeah, patient. Yeah. I forgot that term, yeah.
The identified patient, which often right. they think is the identified problem, right?
Right, yeah.
And the whole idea of the systemic model is to look at the whole system and not just one part of it.
So, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. So. Just a thank you, a shout out.
Brad. Oh, good. Yeah. It's nice to know that I've influenced you, since I felt that it was more
just one
one-sided.
Way. Yeah. That's an illusion.
That's an illusion. All right. Well, I appreciate that. And it's more difficult to. It makes sense to have the whole family involved, and for each individual to find themselves and the wisdom then to grow, evolve, and not be stuck in the same, you know, family members get stuck in the addictive process, you know, around work and money and time. And so to have them be able to look at that at the same time, it sounds lovely, and it really is I believe you're going to have more of a success if, mm-hmm. if they're able to do it. But it's so ingrained with... the different aspects around, you know, the way the family works. It worked for them at that time, and it's hard for them to let go. It's hard for them to let go of their beliefs and ideas and the way things should be or ought to be, and
yeah.
As it is for the addict to let go of the drug of choice, whatever that is.
Well, they did, and you and I have, you know, professed this and taught this, that the addiction to a belief or an idea can be as strong and powerful, and mm-hmm. sometimes as disruptive in a person's life as a drug can be.
Absolutely.
That there's the outcome can be very similar as far as the results that can happen. Mm-hmm. And in the basis of family systems, sometimes the rigidity or the concrete thinking around a belief from a systemic model becomes part of the problem. And as soon as someone, a family member, especially adolescents, and I know we wanted to talk about young adults and adolescents today, not to deviate too quickly, but this idea that, and it was, you know, Eric Erickson had this idea of foreclosure, right, which is mm-hmm. that the children within a family system quite often don't take on or develop their own ideas based upon their own experiences, because they feel there's this pressure to, you know, foreclose on the family system's ideas mm-hmm. or the parents' ideas. So mm-hmm. what's right, what's wrong? And I'm not saying this is good or bad. It's not. Or they take on the certain political or theological belief systems within the family system mm-hmm. and are expected to.
Mm-hmm.
And depend on how rigidly or concrete the family holds on to those ideas, mm-hmm. there's a good chance that someone may eventually rebel against mm-hmm. that system, which is actually a normal process of adolescents or young adults differentiating from their parents. I mean, it's mm-hmm. a normal, healthy thing for them to do, and not always to the enjoyment. enjoyment, but to the chagrin of what the families or the parents expect, you know.
Right.
Because it goes counter to what they think the system should look like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. absolutely. If I think about the family dynamics that I've been working with for the 20 years, it's how do we get them to conform to our way of doing or thinking or believing? And, you know, based on the adults or the parents or the authority within that system, they're doing that because of their experience, their life experience, right? They have a broader view. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm cautious not to get in, well, that's, you know, wrong or you know, it needs to change, but at least the availability to investigate it, right?
Yeah.
You mentioned, you know, the rebellion, you know, I may even have mentioned it before when I was doing the interventions and going to different workshops and seminars to learn more about the family dynamics. It was fascinating to me to find out that the idea that, you know, if a parent were to drink or to smoke, that the child is more likely to take that on. And and there is some truth to that, but because of the psychology, it's actually there's a greater impact if an older sibling drinks or smokes,
right.
Because the natural tendency for a child or a young person is to rebel against the parents. And so they would actually, you know, if it came down just to the parents, say, well, I'm not going to smoke. I don't want to be like them, right? So they'd rebel against that behavior or and yet when they looked at the data, when you had older siblings,
yeah.
Right, more likely. And we're not trying to place blame. It's more about understanding that the psychology and how one individuates within that family system.
Yeah. Right? Well, I mean, I was the youngest, and that's where mm-hmm. I learned about drugs was from my siblings and mm-hmm. learned how to, I guess, you know, when I began to differentiate from my mom, who was, you know, my only parent at the time, it was following in the footsteps of my sister, or mm-hmm. my brother, per se, mm-hmm. but it was my sister, Anne, who I, you know, from my experience, who basically, in by no fault of her own, you know, taught me about this. Mm-hmm. I learned from that and mentored me, not just about drugs, about all kinds of things in mm-hmm. life. That was just part of it. That was part of
Absolutely.
The process
yeah.
of learning to differentiate. Mm-hmm. And I've talked about, you know, this before in a previous podcast. I think actually when I was on Todd Sylvester's podcast, I talked about that. But anyway, this notion, and I agree with you 100%, that siblings often have a larger impact. Mm-hmm. And this can have a big impact on the family system, too, and the individual, because a lot of times siblings will take on the guilt or the shame associated with the effect they have on their younger siblings, too.
Mm-hmm.
So
right. And I want to caution, it's not about, you know, now moving blame to, you know, your siblings.
Yeah, right.
Right? That non-effective when we do that. But to have an idea of not just what the process is, mm-hmm. but how, you know, how it was created. And for one to, instead of, it's my brother's fault, it's more important to say, oh, this is the way it was perceived at this time. How do I adjust that? You mm-hmm. know, knowing that, you know, for what we're talking about, the rebellion is necessary. How do I do that in a way that it really truly is a rebellion mm-hmm. instead of just taking the opposing or the, you know, the duality? Because it's, you know, to do something completely opposite of what, you know, you're rebelling against is really, it's no rebellion, right?
Right.
It's important to find your way.
It's the differentiating yeah. process, mm-hmm. which is a healthy, normal thing to do. Are all the ways that children or, you know, siblings learn to differentiate from their parents or their family system, are they all healthy? Of course not. Mm-hmm. But the process in itself is actually normal and healthy as far mm-hmm. as learning to that separation. I mean, individuate is, I think, mm-hmm. a term you were using. But it, to me, it seems it comes down to what defines us being different from this authority model.
Mm-hmm.
This is just normal. This right. is normal in life. Whether it be parents, and if you want to expand out, you know, more meta, I guess we could say, looking at, you know, systems within society and our culture that, that people will differentiate or rebel against.
Right.
You know, politics, religion, the man.
The man.
The man.
or woman, you know.
Yeah, or woman.
Whatever. A good example of that is the other night in our family group, someone proposed the question, do you think it's more difficult or that the younger generation doesn't have the same capacity to advocate for themselves? And I thought that was interesting. And it came on the heels of someone that was in a treatment center, and the treatment center said, you know, with insurance, this, that, and the other, that, you know, we were hoping to get you into a sober living, but based on the insurance you have, it's not going to happen. And so that individual came back to the family system and was, you know, I've done everything that they've asked me to do, and now there's a game changer in it, right? What do I do? And so then the call was made to me of, you know, what you've dealt with insurance, what's the, you know, the proper or the most effective way to address this? And it was to give the power back to the individual that was looking for the sober living, the client. And it was let them advocate for themselves. There's no, you know, the power lies in the passion of it. And so for that person to advocate and say, this is something that I absolutely know that I need, has a much stronger voice than a parent or, you know, someone else going in and saying, you know, we'd really like this. And so they encouraged that person to do it, and with great results. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, look, this is something I really, truly need. And I've heard a lot of stories around that. I don't know if it's more difficult. Well, I don't need to know that, but it was interesting. So I asked a young man who that I ran into. He was he seemed to me to be focused. He, you know, full-time job. He also had some other ideas of how he could be an entrepreneur. And I asked him. I asked him the question. I said, "Do you think the millennials?" And that was specifically it. Do you think that you've had a harder time advocating for yourself? And he said, I personally don't, but I feel like I'm, you know, one of the few. He said, a lot of my friends, I believe, do. And he added onto that, that there was some kind of defending, an idea of defending going on, you know, with his peers, his, you know, fellow young people. And I found that interesting, and defending would either indicate either being a victim and or a perpetrator of some level. And so I don't know, you know, if that's the, you know, one of the pieces we could look at. However, it's interesting for me to see that there's a lot of assumptions being made, you know, by family members. And if they could just, you know, turn it back over to them, you know, find out, are they having a hard time advocating, you know, instead of posing the question, are they, let's find out, you know, it's, there's a process, but let's get down to the, how's this thing working? And if they are struggling to advocate for themselves, then how do we support them to do that?
Right.
But what we find is, I think a lot of times, in this idea of parent and their obligation to, be of service, you know, to their children, even if they're adult children, a lot of times they pick it up before we even give them a chance to do it.
Right. You mean before the children have a chance to figure out or solve or come up with a solution to deal with the problem themselves.
Yeah.
That the parents intervene.
Correct.
So, so the intervention comes that way. The other idea and thought I had about this, and I know that you mentioned the victim, and that the victim stance can often come into this, especially if there's defensiveness associated with it. This, you know, going back to the idea that family systems have, you know, their specific dynamics associated with them. The idea that often that families do is they point at one person or one thing as the problem. Mm-hmm. And you and I began talking a little bit about this already, but the idea that really this is a systemic issue. And from the systemic model, someone who abuses drugs or alcohol or has a problem with that is usually, I mean, not usually, is looked at as a problem within the system instead of the individual. And the idea that often becomes most troubling for, you know, within family groups is the idea, is this notion or this idea that this problem is created within the family system. For the addict or the alcoholic becomes a representation for the family system, maybe one so that they have a scapegoat, so they have someone to blame the problems on. It doesn't take the responsibility away from the person that's struggling with drugs and alcohol, and they don't, and not to say that they're the victim of the family system, but they are part of it. Mm-hmm. And without that type of, I think, understanding or knowledge, it becomes difficult and very easy. Well, it becomes difficult for a family to have insight or awareness of it. Mm-hmm. And it's also difficult because the idea that how am I responsible for someone else's choices? Which doesn't make a lot of sense when it comes to accountability. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm accountable that he takes drugs. No, not personally. That's not. But the system in itself is somehow helping, facilitating, or propagating the outcome. Mm-hmm. And that's what, you know, we try to look at. Because, no, you're not responsible for that person's choices. Mm-hmm. But they're obviously don't have the ability to, you know, differentiate or individuate from the family system in a healthy way. They've just done it in an unhealthy or a way that's brought negative consequences to their lives. And, I mean, we can talk about all the causes and the reasons for that. Mm-hmm. One of the most common ones, I think, is the idea that, you know, seeking out attention, and it's a way to get attention, you know, from parents or from people within the system. But that's not that always the case. But that's just one example of that. I'll take any type of attention, you know.
Right. Yeah.
And or maybe, you know, it's the way that I learn or I know how to deal with some type of pain or trauma in my life. And and so the pain or the trauma could or could not be from the family system. But if the system itself doesn't have the tools or the ability to deal with someone's pain or trauma, and they maybe they don't understand really the nature of the problem, It may be easy or convenient to kind of sweep it under the rug a little bit, or send that person off to get help somewhere else from somebody. But again, what that does is it isolates the one person from the system, but keeps re-identifying them as the patient or the problem.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right. And if somebody is struggling, especially with addiction today, you have to address that because of the life-threatening nature, right? Like going to the scene of a automobile accident, you're going to assess the situation and see who's in the most danger and address that first. But using that analogy is that there's a lot more going on. This person may be struggling more critically than others, but that doesn't lessen the need for everyone to get attention at the scene of the accident.
Yes.
And I would say, you know, even those that aren't injured, you know, either physically or, you know, using that analogy is that the witnessing of it, you know, the passengers, you know, what is that formulating and within that system? So when we're asking, you know, how much do, you know, families participate or what's beneficial, I would say, you know, more participation would actually assist that, you know, all involved, right? And when I say more, it's not learning about the other's problem or addiction, you know, to find out, oh, this is what causes addiction. But where are you as a person struggling as well, right? And so a lot of times the behavior of an addict is amplified, but it's still going on within the family. Maybe it's workaholism, you know.
Sure.
There's a shopping or a sex addiction or something that may not be as known but is right below the surface, right? And
Gaming, pornography, which have become more and more. And now they actually have, you know, specific diagnoses for now, you know, instead of it being something that was not looked at within in this system. And you bring up shopping or consumerism. We were talking a little bit about this yesterday with Robert about how powerful that is and how many problems that causes in our world today.
Yeah. And, me trying to figure out everything and get to the very root cause, you know, that's where I go. I think, well, there's the primary dysfunction. In this culture is the overconsumption. You know, most every addict that I've ever met with, and I can say I haven't had an exception with this, but I haven't worked with a lot of dual diagnosis, you know, the narcissist. But there's this idea of I'm not enough, you know. And I can honestly say without exception or very little, That's a common theme of a person's psychology is I've always felt like I wasn't enough, you know, and there's that value system. And then, you know.
And shame gets tied into that.
Absolutely.
You know, if I'm not enough, then something's wrong with me.
Right.
Or that I'm broken. I mean, that notion that something's broken, you know, and to begin to challenge that belief system is really an important beginning part of the process, especially within the family, because the family can surely take on that role. Yeah, again, this is the problem. We need to fix this problem. This is broken over here.
Right. how could they possibly think they're not enough? And especially coming from a parent who thinks, you know, they've got this belief that they are everything, you know, and they are. They're an extension of their own life. And so there's a lot of attachments, you know, put onto the children. If we could start to see those and identify that it's that, you know, as a parent, if I project that onto a child, and we hear it all the time, you know, I want to give them the life that I never had, right? Or I'm trying to save them from the difficulties I had. That's a noble cause.
To have a better life than I had. I mean, this was a... Which, you know, today things are a little bit different and what we associate with having more or having better. A lot of the stories within family systems for a long time is I want them to have opportunities and the things that I didn't have as a kid. You know, the opportunity to go to college or something like that. I'm just using these as examples. But this does come back to this idea of more, too. It does. There is this association that, you know, I want them to have things I didn't have, so I want them to have more. And there's just a subtle little message that happens in there is I'm supposed to have more.
Right.
I'm supposed to have more options, more opportunities, you know. And there's a psychology in there that probably is unhealthy for, you know, for various reasons.
Right.
That we create this template over and over again that things are always supposed to be more and better and bigger and more opportunities. And it's about this ongoing idea of expansiveness that, that maybe... getting away from really what the problems are in the first place and actually adding to them.
Absolutely, because the shadow side of more is less, right? And so when a person tries to, you know, is so focused on more, one would actually create less. You know, if a person tries too hard to be beautiful, they create ugliness. If one, you know, attempts to elevate themselves, you know, in status, you know, beyond, you know, a reasonable amount, then they actually are going to be seen as smaller. So, you know, too much of focus on one thing will create the opposite.
And comparison must come in here somewhere, too. I mean, some kind of inventory or scorekeeping for oneself is, you know, what's the next level? What's the next thing to do? I mean, going back to gaming, what a big part of that plays in this. The mind, right? I've got to defeat this. I've got to go on to the next, you know. It's maybe just part of human nature, too. I may be
it would be. It's about being in motion. Right. And not to stagnate or be stuck, you know. So if you take that and we don't. So what is it that an individual is trying to accomplish through that, you know, success or defeating the adversary, whatever that is, you know, and how is it playing out? How do you apply that into the day-to-day life? You know, so you don't get lost in a game, in an unconscious process of succeeding, because there's the idea, you know, all the war games, all the, you know, the race, I don't even know what they got out there now, you know, as far as gaming goes.
Fortnite.
No, oh, my God.
Fortnite is the big one.
Okay.
Because I have clients, a couple adolescent clients who have issues with that. Mm-hmm. And they definitely, and I do family therapy with some of these, some of these families where there's a son who, that's one of the issues they have is the amount of time they spend with media, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't. I'm not a gamer, so I'm not here to advocate one way or the other for that. But when someone's life becomes so wrapped up, and even their social life, this is what this young man said, was, my social life has become wrapped up in this. I communicate and talk with people, you know, he has a headset on, he's talking to these people, and he says, that's, you know, I'm spending time with people, mom, dad. I'm actually communicating, I'm socializing, you know, and I said, but what are you doing while you're socializing? Well, yeah, we're doing a lot of adventures and killing, you know?
Yeah.
And again, I'm not saying what's right or wrong here, but this the idea that my social world exists with a headset on and there's no actual human contact. There's the contact with humans is a digital world, which is a game that propagates violence.
Right.
So yeah.
And when I think about gaming, I'll go back to my. When I was into gaming, there was a game called Pac-Man, and I'm laughing. But I was around when Pong came out too, and it, the little ball and the two lit up sticks. But Pac-Man was interesting because I even back then it would have been in the early '80s, maybe late '70s. That thing consumed me. I remember. Trying to go to sleep, and the game was running over and over in my head, and I would play it out, and then it's a different degree of violence, but it's still eating and attacking, right?
It's consuming.
It's consuming. Wow, there you go. Yeah, and so it's just the evolution of that. Once again. It's easy to say, oh, and that's terrible in our gender. What happened when we used to play kick the can, right? Everybody, our social network used to be, and Robert talked about this, is it is so small now. You know, it used to, our parameters as children were a neighborhood, and sometimes even exceed that boundary. And now it's, within the confines of a room, a machine, the headsets.
Yeah.
And
I think he was saying like it's 100 feet of the house now, and it used to be, hundreds of yards or, or a mile or something like that. It used to be much bigger. And the strange part about that is, especially when we look at, how family systems have adapted and what's changed within family systems to create this. Certain things are down. I mean, violence is down. Abductions are down. Certain levels of abuse, associated with that are down. But somehow we've become more, contained and confined within these smaller protected circles, so that if you look at this from a systemic and a family system, it kind of makes sense why a child would go, okay, well, here's a safe environment I get to go act out in and play in, whatever it is, cops and robbers, or this is probably not a healthy thing to say, but I can remember when I was a kid, people playing cowboys and Indians.
Yeah.
I can remember that. And all kinds of, different types of games. Obviously, kick the can and hide and seek and those kinds of things and capture the flag. That was a big one, too. And now everything becomes so contained and so controlled. So, looking at a child who's lost within a headset and a screen, a television screen, playing a game, it almost kind of makes sense that part of the problem from a systemic point of view is, sort of the why we want to control and contain everything. And maybe a symptom of that is this gaming world that, that people right. go into. They don't explore other worlds outside right. of themselves in their neighborhoods or in their towns because they're either, one, not allowed to, or they're taught to fear it.
Right. And it can be a scary place out there. And not that, you know, this level of violence and goings on in the world is new. I mean, it's you know, I've heard people talking about the history of violence, and what we're addressing now doesn't compare to other times, mm-hmm. right? The point that I think that's coming up for me, and is, you know, if I knew, I would absolutely, if I knew the answer, right, I would share it with everyone. Mm-hmm. And so as I'm sitting here talking to you, and I know that, you know, you're an intelligent man, I've got my experience, but the truth is that we have an idea of what's going on, but we haven't found a way to bring it together and actually, you know, create a strategy or a solution other than identifying where we're separate, right? Mm-hmm. That, oh, in my generation, we did this. And so somehow in that, I think the wisdom is within each person to not identify the problem, you know, specifically like gaming, mm-hmm. right? That's the problem and that's got to stop. But how do we work with this process that's going on? Because it's happening for a reason. Like you said, you know, safety and security, you know, one of the...
And fear. Yeah. And,
right. And our need to feel safe, be loved, you know, the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right?
Right. Safety and security on the bottom. So right. that's where you start, right?
Right. And it's a lot safer to hang out in your room with your headset on. How do we interact with those closest to us? And bring in the wisdom that that's available, you know, mm-hmm. through the authority, through our parents, through our siblings. Instead of saying, "Well, that's the problem. You got to do less of it." Is it possible that we can investigate that with them, participate, and so there can be a wisdom created through it? Because, identifying. The separateness is different than healing it.
Yeah.
And just like we were talking earlier, the family system gets, you create these beliefs out of survival in the family. Then the nobility in saying, I want, or it's important to me that I assist my children in avoiding the unnecessary suffering, whatever that is, right? That's a noble cause, but that doesn't mean that you just tell them what to do or make it easy for them. It's actually allowing yourself to be present and be with them,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And there's that, you know, do we send them off to treatment somewhere? No, we agreed that this treatment includes the whole family. And not just in understanding it, but participating, right? And be willing to look at ourselves.
Sure.
Right?
Of course.
And there's this idea, I think, with parents, and I hold it even with, you know, step kids, that I know and they don't. Right. Wow. You know.
If you'd only lived what I've lived through.
Yeah.
There was a great Far Side theater when I was a kid. It was, you know, if you had the life I had, I grew up in a shoebox at the bottom of the lake, and I slept on a bed of wet leaves. You know, I mean, you have no idea what it is, what tough life was. Walking to school in the morning, right. I had to swim the quarter of a mile even before I could walk to school.
Right, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's outrageous, you know, the ideas. Right. But I remember that story from my youth, listening to that strange radio program, because it was about saying, you know, how terrible things could be. You mm-hmm. know, we think our lives are so terrible. You don't know how hard it is. So adults often thinking right. that they have the answers. Right. And of course, as a parent, that kind of gets wired into it or cooked into the process mm-hmm. of, well, I'm supposed to be this all-knowing mentor. Am I not mm-hmm. supposed to be? And yeah. there's There's this idea that I know, because as a parent, we're also supposed to be humble and admit that we don't know everything and that it's okay to find it somewhere else. This is, I mean, think about family systems, right? So the notion that if everything the family knew and it was all right and correct and 100% true all the time, if they really believe that, I mean, excuse my French, but they're kind of fucked, because the truth of the matter is there can be no absolutes, no matter what the belief system is. There's got to be room for dialogue and change and to be challenged in our belief systems. Probably one of the hardest things for families to deal with is when kids don't foreclose on the family system and believe that there's something else, or whether it be they don't want to follow the same religion or they don't want to follow the same belief systems within the family. And we haven't even talked about dysfunctional families where abuse and things like that are going on. You know, I mean, but again, it's the same kind of patterning that happens. And so being able to dialogue or being able to talk about things, then a couple things happen. So if a family can accept and propagate healthy communication where people are heard, everyone is, I mean, at least people are listened to, right? That they feel like heard. I mean, this, I think you put up the notion of the young man who you asked about, you know, advocating, you know, how is that? Are you able to advocate for yourself? And this notion is, well, to advocate for yourself, someone has to listen. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, otherwise there's no communication. I mean, you can talk to somebody, it can all be top down, you know, this is the way it is, the way the world is, this is who God is, you know, this is who you vote for, you know, this is just the way it is. Don't believe anything else.
Right.
You're setting up to be your system to be challenged as soon as you say, this is the right way.
Right.
I mean, you're saying, okay, come challenge me.
Right.
Right.
I love it. I just, you helped me get you assisted me with your wisdom to raise my wisdom, which is, there has to be someone there to listen. And without that, it's complaining, you know?
And I think that's good call.
Yeah, so thank you for that. Yeah. And it makes more sense of his response is, you know, defending, you know?
I'm okay the way I am. I'm okay the way I think. I'm okay who I am. I don't need to have you tell me that I'm right or wrong. You don't have to approve of me. But for kids that are looking for someone to tell them they're okay, I mean, you brought up the idea that someone, you know, someone says, I'm not enough. And if they don't get that from the family, no, you're not enough because you don't have the same belief system we have. And don't pretend like, you know, there's one better than ours. You're already setting yourself up for failure. The system's already, you know, this is cooked into it that somebody's going to differentiate and get out of there.
Right.
You know, so again, not listening, not hearing someone out and not allowing them to have their own opinion about something becomes difficult. Right. Now, you know, it's what I suppose the idea, the, you know, the theory that, you know, the hot stove, you know, everyone's got to learn about it. You can tell someone over and over again, but do they have to learn? Do they have to, everything have to be learned experientially?
Yeah. It's helpful. But there's the difference between, you know, intelligence and wisdom.
Yeah.
Right. Intelligent.
Applying knowledge. Right.
Right.
Wisdom,
right. There's an intelligence to, well, I don't have to touch it because, you know, based on someone, you know, that I trust and has had that experience. So the wisdom is, I'm going to jump back a little bit because when you were talking, that word came up that through your wisdom, I was able to raise my own. The idea that parents are, you know, I know how to do this life or how to, you know, best put yourself in a position to succeed. There's the knowing, but if that were true, because you talked about if we go back, if that was true, you know, we'd still have women not voting, and we have slavery, and we'd have, you know, there's so much that
the earth would still be flat,
right? And
just
you know, women's, you know, that were empowering themselves would be burned. So we really don't know, you know. However, I think that the younger generation has that, but we're not going to get to it through I know best. It's through this idea of going beyond that into our wisdom to assist them to awaken their wisdom.
Right.
Right? Because if I know something, now it's a competition. And you said comparable, right? It's always more because we're comparing. And which is, you know, creates a competition. And And there's, you know, where not enough comes in. It's a competition. You know, this is enough. This person has a nice car. They have the job. They have the, and so they're enough. But I don't, right? And knowing isn't going to get us through this. But we all have a wisdom that I believe is connected. And so it's through our own wisdom that we can assist others to raise their wisdom.
Right. Sure. And knowing how to apply our experience and knowledge. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you go back to this, I mean, it gets simplified in the Serenity Prayer, but the notion that I make choices and understand what is mine. Mm-hmm. And there's this wisdom within taking accountability for that. Mm-hmm. And acknowledging that I'm limited by that too. I mean, mm-hmm. there's wisdom in being able to openly talk about our limits, mm-hmm. and what our capacity is to be human and to be frail and to not have all the answers all the time, but to have this sense of divine. I mean, I know I'm just going off a little bit, but this sense of divinity within ourselves, whatever you, mm-hmm. however you want to define that. I like the word wisdom too, because mm-hmm. it's this sense of living through a deep understanding of knowing what's true for us, mm-hmm. and being able to share that with others and being able to listen to others. Mm-hmm. I also think means, and maybe this kind of brings full circle of what the idea with a family support group is, you know, why they're so important and why for all these years you still have mm-hmm. this important component of your life, but also, you know, what you offer, what services you offer to the community is being able to offer that wisdom to someone else and then being listening to them through that and being able to rise up yourself and be mm-hmm. able to show up in that person's life.
Absolutely.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. And it really is a move. And from the last podcast that we did, you know, we talked more about the passion that I have doing the inner work and really the integration of both the masculine and feminine qualities and way of being, right? Mm-hmm. And Joseph Campbell was one of the first ones that I was listening to or followed that was talking about wisdom and how it's a surprise to most people that the idea of wisdom is actually a feminine trait, that it's a receptive process.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And, you know, I've heard, you know, the wise woman, but it's more in my head or my understanding that it was a masculine. But this thinking, the intellect, is a needed aspect and contribution to the entire process. But it's not been real helpful, you know, knowing this is the do's, the don'ts, when we look at addiction, we say, gosh, can't you see the rash? You know, people that get addicted have tough lives, you know. Use your brain, you know. Well, it absolutely has a place.
Use your brain. But my brain's been wired for addiction.
Yeah.
I'm using it quite well.
Yeah, yeah. So this idea of I know best, which would be a masculine in that context, mm-hmm. Attribute, has had some success. I mean, it had success with me in my early recovery, but more so recently has been this receptive, this I don't know, but I'm available to learn, right? And when the family groups that or the family members that I've been working with, they come across that, and when they step into that, the responsibility piece drops, the overwhelmness, the obligation, and so now they become more in a relationship, you know, while they're connecting to the idea of their wisdom, not their knowing. And I just, once again, if I had the answer, well, then it'd be boring. Then what? But but I do think that it's important because, you know, those that my mentors and the people that I turn to, they're pointing to the same thing, you mm-hmm. know, that intellect will only get you so far.
Right.
And more intellect isn't going to be, or more knowledge is not going to increase your chances of success, whatever you're trying to get into. But a more receptive allowance and flow specifically allowing that feminine aspect, seems to have a greater impact for people to find a sense of peace, happiness, you know, less suffering, whatever that is.
Yeah.
So I would just say that, you know, my family group, we're moving towards that, to not trying to figure it out, but allowing, having an allowance of seeing what's going on with the wisdom, right? Instead of trying to fix it,
right?
And that's the old model is, all right, what's broke? This is what you got to do to fix it. Really, you know, take it apart and see what's really going on here, you know? And how do we approach it from a more nurturing aspect?
Okay, so this idea, I think you're touching upon here, of nurturing and how do we nurture this, is really important and really valid. But there are a couple things that come up, and part of the reason why sometimes conflict happens within family systems is, I think, directly due or associated to a lack of nurturing. Maybe, and this maybe gets back to what we were talking about earlier, mm-hmm. the idea of lack of listening or, you know, healthy communication, and part of the dynamic that leads to that, and it is also what we were talking about, was that, you know, families, you know, parents always think, you know, they know what's right. Mm-hmm. And the truth of the matter is, if someone's trying to differentiate, and we know that's a healthy part of development and growing up and those kinds of things, if they're trying to differentiate and they believe that there's a truth for themselves, whatever you want to call that. I mean, mm-hmm. you and I talk about words like authentic self or artistic self and, you know, the true self and, mm-hmm. and those kinds of things. Discovering that can be a powerful force in when people are becoming self-aware and what feels right and true.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that this is not a fixed point, by the way. The idea of being able to learn and nurture our truth and be able to listen to that voice within us. And that's the voice when I speak of authenticity or mm-hmm. That artistic soul voice or soul heart song or something within mm-hmm. us. When we can learn to listen to that, it becomes a self-nurturing kind of process when we mm-hmm. listen to it. If we have an influence or force around us, and I guess I should be using I statements here, Brett. If I have an influence or a force around me that's telling me not to listen to that voice or don't trust that voice and to trust them, or, you know, what's wrong with me? I'm crazy. Those things can't be true. This internal conflict begins, mm-hmm. and it makes sense why people cut themselves off more and more, and maybe they don't fully differentiate or they don't fully individuate and become independent in some way, and they kind of lose themselves in that process, mm-hmm. leading to addiction and obsessive and compulsive natures, and that again becomes part of a dynamic within the family system. So, full circle here. I mean, mm-hmm. what are the ways in which to facilitate and support, and this is, I love the word, nurture. You know, how do we do that? Where mm-hmm. do we find that? And this leads into one of the other things we wanted to talk about today, right? Which mm-hmm. Was, you know, how do we get out of ourselves and feel more actually, and what I mean by ourselves, you know, sort of the talk and the
mimote. Persona.
I mean, yeah, the persona, the mimote that's constantly happened. Mimote, sorry. Getting mimosas and, you know, self chatter, a little mixed up there. How do we begin to separate from that so we can listen to that voice and nurture that voice within us, mm-hmm. that soul song or that yeah. heart song, which I think is also where wisdom comes out of too.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways that you know, you and I have been involved in doing that is getting out into nature, especially mm-hmm. the desert,
right.
you know, making that transition. And I think we always knew when you and I started doing the retreats, you know, years ago or a decade, I don't know, about 20, it's been 15, 16,
when I was
17
younger.
Years. Yeah, when we were so much younger then.
Yeah.
When we began this, we knew that taking people out and having them be with themselves and learning to be still with themselves and learning to listen was probably one of the most valuable tools you could give them so that they would learn to have some sense of authenticity, especially mm-hmm. if there was so much shame or doubt or fear in their lives. And of course, this came through the process of working with people in treatment. And here's this opportunity to be able to step out of all that and be able to learn to sit with myself, mm-hmm. to be able to understand that actually I can nurture myself. Mm-hmm. And what a fascinating experience to think that it's not something outside of myself either. You know, this mm-hmm. this notion that, you know, it really does all begin with me, that I'm responsible for my self-care and those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But if we have never been taught that, if we've always taught that it, you know, it's going to be someone else, it's going to be a partner, or it's going to be a job, or it's going to be God. And this is in no way being blasphemous to any theological system out there. But that if it's always looking outside of ourselves for some kind of truth and wisdom, and we can't find it within ourselves, then that search or that unease, that wanting to, you know, to have more, to be okay, is constantly, we can't satisfy ourselves. We can't feel mm-hmm. okay by ourselves or being alone. So the stillness, mm-hmm. finding that stillness. That began truly for me, I mean, in different ways when I was young. I used to get it from the ocean, surfing or swimming or body surfing as a very young child. I mean, I felt so connected to the earth back then. I felt so much a part of everything around me. And then now as an adult, you know, I made that transition to the desert. Mm-hmm. And that becomes such a powerful way to connect. And then taking other people down, right? Mm-hmm. Becoming to learn to hold a container which other people can, and no guarantees, but hopefully they'll have an opportunity to discover those pieces, right. and begin to listen to right. that heart song, that soul song.
Right, which is a huge journey. I mean, it's when we've talked about interventions, you know, the desert, and even when I first joined you and others going into the desert, there was this idea that, oh, that'll be lovely, and then, oh, you know what would make it nicer is the stereo, or, you know, I even considered getting a, I don't think I did, you might not have, you may have said, Brett, that's not wise, but, you know, bring in a movie projector to put on the side of the mountain. I think we actually did that once, you know, and I got to, you know, laugh at myself. It's, you know, how do I bring
the comforts of home?
Yeah, how do I let go of all of that without actually changing, you
right,
know?
Right.
And, you know, the desert represents this place that for me, at least, is, and today, and it's been a while since I've been there, but really a place to go and be and not do, you know, just to find a place to be. And that this idea of self-nurturing or find a way to address whatever issues, crisis or tension, resistance, mm-hmm. Through a more nurturing process. So when I was doing interventions and I talked to the family, I said, this has, you know, been a very difficult process, you know, to speak one's truth, to hold boundaries, to really tough love, you know, with people. And I'd say it's important that you take care of yourself, that you nurture yourself after this process. And ultimately people say, well, how do you do that? And I would, you know, give my best direction on that at the time, which was really ineffective. And I don't know how. Well, it would be things like, well, you know, take your time. You know, allow yourself a hot bath. Use extra bubbles. You know, these kind of things. But I believe it's deeper than that. To nurture oneself is to drop that persona, to the competitiveness, the idea of more, right? And just find that stillness within yourself. Because that's the idea for me, is that that's who I am. You know, the rest is part of the game and the fun and you know, the persona that I put out to people. But to nurture myself, not so much, yes, physically to do that, but to do that at a soul level, right?
Yeah.
But to nurture myself, I have to some level connect, which is going to be, you know, done, like you're saying, in the desert where I can just be, you know, and not take the, you know, the movie projector to watch Castaways, you know, in the middle of the desert. Although it's fun, and I guess you could do that. But to take time to actually be with yourself, to go find yourself. I don't know if a lot of people have. I know I hadn't. And I still, you know, I'm on that journey to know who I am.
Well, you know, we were talking about this yesterday a little bit. Actually, we've probably talked about it numerous times, but this, the idea of the hero's journey. Okay. And I really believe that there's this aspect to the desert, you know, like it would be in a vision quest or in a walkabout or something like that. It's about separating ourselves from all those things, like like the movies, like the media. I mean, we just always joke, you know, it's great we don't have self-service down here. It's gotten a little better, which is, you know, too bad. But I still tell people when we go down, if I, you know, when I do, yeah, there's no self-service down there. So just, you know, put it on airplane mode once we hit the road, you know, the dirt road, you know, the sand road. Just go ahead and put it on airplane mode, you know. So... But most people just do that. They just leave it that way unless there's an emergency, and which has happened. And then we go, okay, well, we can go stand on this one spot up here and hopefully get service, you know, that kind of thing. Anyway.
But leaving that behind is difficult, you know. So if we look at it as a way to point to a way that families can heal, repair, to... relieve some of the suffering, you know, that life causes, not just addiction. Really, I think what we're talking about is what can you do interpersonally for yourself to connect to the wisdom, to the nurturing, to the self-healing. And this, I don't know where it comes from, but the idea of parent, that all-knowing, is all right. I've grown up. I've had all these experiences, and now I know. And yeah, there's some personal growth, but it's not that necessary. And for me, I, you know, just turned 55. I feel like I'm just now capable and able to do the inner journey, you know, and I don't like the word work. We've gone over that, you know, homework and all that, but
I'm working on that.
But to have the, but to be able to go and do the inner journey, you know, to have that experience, it really has only become available to me, you know, in these last years, you know. Before that, I was out, naturally doing the competing, you know, the mythological fighting dragons, saving maidens, you know, making my place in the world, you know. And then ultimately, no matter how much success I could find in that, it came the, those moments of, you know, it's just, there's something more. I can feel it. And so it's in these years, I mean, I can't call them later years because who knows, but end year, you know, it's only now that I'm able to really go and get the richness that I see as for my life, you know. It's all been a great experience, but the richness, the richness and the you know, the fireworks show, you know, with the big ending, you know, that's now. You know, this is where I can go in and really get the essence of what this has been about for me. You know, and so I would encourage, you know, anyone that has a loved one, whether it be a child or spouse or anyone, take that opportunity to know yourself better. You know, because addiction is a representation of lost. Know, one being lost. And so use that experience. I don't want to tell you what to do, but what a great opportunity to go find you and nurture it. You know, when we nurture something, what you know, the nurturing, it feels wonderful, but we nurture something so it can grow and expand. And how can each individual do that, you know, through what appears to be a crisis, you know? My experience has been the crisis in my life has really been the catalyst.
Yeah.
You know, it's through those that I've transformed.
I have a coworker, Wendy, who I'm probably going to get the words mixed up a little bit, but she defined addiction as I think the inability or not being able to process legitimate suffering. That said something along those lines, where we actually have this suffering, this trauma, from whatever source it's from, and not having the ability to process it. One of the offshoots or symptom of that, not being able to do that work, is addiction. Mm-hmm. And I like this concept, and we put it up on the board quite a lot. Like, still, which goes up on the board is it's never about them, no matter who they are.
Yeah,
which is a great mantra. But these two together, I find really purposeful. One is about it's about me. That I mean, they're both about me. You know, about accountability. One is what I do is what I choose to do, or you know, what I feel, or how I behave or think is about me. It's not about anyone else. And then this if there's a problem in my life or something where I'm unable to cope, or I become obsessive compulsive about something, or a habit turns into an addiction or something like that, that's in my inability to process something that's legitimate and that often trauma or suffering. Mm-hmm. And the notion of that I like is that's kind of like the shadow work, right? That ability to go in, you know, dark night of the soul stuff, I think is so important and so valuable. And that's really, I mean, everyone needs to do this on some level. They need to find that instead of fear it. Well, I won't say that sounds a little judgmental, but the idea is learning to learn to embrace that part of the journey. Mm-hmm. Of deep soul discovery, of deep of being able to explore the shadows without shame, to be able to heal those parts of ourselves, you know, without the pain, without the need to medicate that pain or to avoid it, and to learn to embrace those components and those pieces, because the shadow makes up who we are, makes up who I am. Mm-hmm. And it's not something separate. And I think that a lot of times, you know, and this is for family systems too, is people don't want to always go in and do that kind of work. So they focus and they take on or adapt something else in their life. Mm-hmm. It could be a religion or a theology that they embrace that because they don't always want to go in and do their other deep work. Or it could be, you know, some type of sports or being an athlete of some kind. And don't get me wrong, there's nothing wrong with any of this. There's nothing wrong. But if we become obsessive and compulsive about it, where it begins to run our life, then there is something. There is something that's off, you know, because there's no real balance, and we're not living a wholehearted life, which kind of comes back to. So, I love this dynamic of going out and seeking to become one or whole and be able to live that way again.
Yeah, and you used the word need in there, and I will say that a lot of times when I hear the word need, I have an automatic resistance. But I believe in the context that you just used.
Oh, good catch, by the way. Good catch.
Yeah, I know. But I think in the context of what we're talking about, that there is a necessity, right? That
maybe calling's a better word.
Well,
I mean, it may be need, but I understand what you're saying.
Right.
It's really, I think we all have a calling to do our work. It is hardwired into us, a calling to show up and do our work and to walk through the shadow.
Absolutely. And that you know, there are certain needs. You know, we need food and water and shelter. There is some need to the psychological and the emotional because, you know, we pick up coping strategies. Mm-hmm. And you know, thank the universe for those. And a lot of times I think I find an answer and I go, oh, no, mistake the answer for another life coping strategy, you know. But there is, I believe, a necessity for one at whatever level they're capable of is to slow down enough and get a sense of who they are beyond this competitive process that this culture has facilitated. Mm-hmm. You know, this idea, we go back to not enough, that doesn't come from within, that comes from without. And then somehow in there gets skewed that we really believe that the inward self isn't enough. And it really is an external process. Mm-hmm. And because it makes money. And if you don't have enough, then we have what you need.
No, you got it. It's a really good explanation of that.
Right. Yeah. And I don't even, at this point, sticking to what I'm hopefully pointing to for myself and anyone that may listen and want, a pointer is, you know, even to fight that and say, oh, that's wrong, and now I gotta not consume. It's more about not trying to fix it, but going in and finding that truth, nurturing my truth, myself, mm-hmm. and allowing it to grow, right? So for me, if my experience has been, if I do that, then the need to consume isn't as great. Because I'm identifying with the true self. Right?
That was beautifully said.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, the true self and the necessity in finding your way to individuate through the mythology of the Golden Grail and King Arthur and they sought out this quest to find the Grail unveiled. And as they set out together, and when they got to the edge of the forest, the beginning of the journey, mm-hmm. it was a known wisdom that it would, the way it spoke of in the myth is that it would be an abomination against God for them to go on a path already that had been tread on, mm-hmm. and that each individual would need to make their own way. Mm-hmm. And there's that individuation. And when we watch people struggling and we see it as a struggle, we can see that although messy and chaotic and maybe not so skillful, what they're really attempting to do is to individuate. Right?
Yeah.
And not get into, I've got to fix it, but through our combined wisdom, could we facilitate a personal growth versus the destruction of the individual?
So then this kind of can come back to this notion that, individuating from a system and individuating and learning to be still within ourselves and, whole within ourselves, when for whatever reason, we have kind of lost, or in some ways, and maybe loss isn't the best word, Brett, but we don't have the same social and cultural experiences in place, rites of passage that, mm-hmm. that facilitate this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so that when there isn't those kinds of practices and rituals and sort of a sacredness involved in rites of passage, which is about individuation and mm-hmm. differentiation. Maybe that lack of that kind of fosters this lack of being whole and being able to you know, work and accept ourselves as we are, and may foster the obsessive and the compulsive and the addictive nature. And, you know, I mean, we did start talking about the idea of, you know, going out into the desert and being able to have that experience and you know, separating ourselves from the system, this giant system that we live in, you know, with the media and the information and you know, the industrialization, to be out in the middle of nowhere and just sit with oneself or sit with a group of people and deal with what's real
right
in that moment. Yeah. And I mean, traditionally, you know, we were talking about the hero's journey, talking about, you know, Buddha's or Siddhartha's journey, the importance of that, how that came about, you know, by him differentiating from his family. Mm-hmm. And then in the Native American culture, the idea of the vision quest, where you know, you're going to go out and this is you. This is your life. You're going to meet yourself through nature.
Right.
And you're going to find out how you survive.
Right.
And come back with your story.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right. And with that is not only how you survive, but also how you die in that.
And how you... The part of yourself dying, right? The symbolic death, yes.
Yeah, right, that the persona aspect of it. It's interesting that you say, you know, go to the desert and to find that stillness and to begin to see one's true self.
Mm-hmm.
And then also the related piece, to be out there with other people. So I see the value in this. Going it alone, but there's such a great value to do this with a group of people, and I would say not even like-minded. In fact,
yeah.
You know,
this is true.
I found that the greatest growth potential and that I've been able to bring in is through how I project onto other people.
Yes.
That's what relationships are about, you know, this idea I'm going to find my soulmate, and we attribute it to finding that person.
Right.
I think there's some truth to that.
That's going
in,
to...
Yeah, I find that person that is going to mirror my shadow. You know, I'll project my shadow onto them, and then if I can pull that back, if they'll hold my goal long enough, I then get to know myself, you know, and maybe it's my false self that I can release. Or maybe it's that authentic true self that I get to nurture, you know, and only through relationships have I been able to obtain that, right?
No, right on.
Yeah.
You're right. Good awareness of that presentation, because I think about that, you know, the different menagerie or, you know, people that come together that have sometimes been on these trips, and especially the sacredness of all, you know, sitting in a lodge together. This idea of getting into a lodge space, and for our listeners, I'm talking about a sweat lodge, a traditional ceremony that cultures all over the world have used for eons. I mean, for you know, tens of thousands of years. Is a way of bringing people together, and that powerfulness afterwards, that the sense of community that comes out of that shared experience.
Yeah,
because it does push, you know, physical, emotional, and mental limits in such a way that and there's that opportunity within that space and holding space about connection. But also about being very vulnerable and seeing people in that space and knowing that there's maybe for the first time we you know, knowing there's a support system there. So I appreciate you bringing in the community aspect of this, because right on. I mean, that's that's partly what makes this such a powerful and sacred experience.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, there is the solo journey, the hero's journey, that of going in and going on that quest, you know, and or walkabout. But then there's this community experience, which is so powerful and so needed as well.
Yeah. Well, it when I look at the hero's journey, and I've attached to that idea, initially a lot of ego was present, and you know, knowing me, I'm sure there is still, you know, more to come. But I have had this awareness that even though it is, you know, the hero's journey is something that one needs to step into and take his own path, you know, that you travel on your own, right? Mm-hmm. It's the motivation is through that community. The idea of the hero's journey is to go into one's own shadow and bring back the consciousness and the wisdom, the collective consciousness, into the community. So it's a way to save self is a leaving self, and it's really as important as bringing back the information to the community, not in I know kind of way, but as a service to be available, mm-hmm. and be relatable, compassionate with others. You know, that dark night of the soul, so to speak, or the shadow work, there's no better way to foster compassion.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, when you're in that work or that experience, it can be very... a lot, and I learned a lot about compassion through that experience. So that's what I'm talking about, bringing it back. Not that, oh, I know something that you don't, but I now have a deeper understanding of the suffering.
Yes.
And I also have a deeper understanding of the joy. And if I bring that back and I'm in that position, I have a completely different relationship with my friends, family, colleagues, clients. And so I set out to save myself, and in this I found the need to be of service.
Yeah.
You know, that I lose myself, really.
Yeah.
And that separateness that we have.
I love that, the idea of losing self.
Yeah.
Yeah, or at least the story, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Having the story just sort of dissolve away for a while, and you know, and then having a choice whether I want to go back to it or not. Yeah. You know, something came to me, and we'll look towards kind of wrapping this up a little bit, but as you were sharing that last little bit, I all of a sudden, and talking about this from a community aspect, I started to see the family system slightly differently, from a different angle. Especially one that's in crisis, maybe where addiction has taken a hold.
Mm-hmm.
As the addiction is a self-created crisis within the family, or someone suffering from trauma, addiction, or abuse, or something, as a crisis to attempt to bring the family, you know, to shake it up a bit. And under the systemic model, this would, I guess, be accurate. You know, it's a system, you know, for. Part of its purpose is to project problems away, to project the problems away onto someone else within the family system. But then again, there's this great opportunity that when the family gets shaken up, that there's this option that they can come together and learn how to deal with the crisis. And just like with, you know, this sense of community, you know, this the crisis itself being created by an individual because they want to see the family work together. They want to see the family have a shared experience and hopefully become better at listening and better at nurturing and better at holding each other accountable and hopefully willing to allow people to differentiate without it being a problem within that system.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the thought that came up and as we talk about the desert is to return to our nature. We forget that.
Yes.
That
yes.
We are nature. And that people report all the time that, I feel so much better when I'm in the mountains or in the desert. And let's not forget the obvious, you know, it's because we're returning to ourself.
Yeah.
Right? And this idea of finding ourself, it's a lot easier to do it when we're in the same neighborhood.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, so really to return to our nature and what's it trying to tell us? You know, what's our family tree? What's it trying to tell us? We've got a leaf that, you know, is wilted and not doing so well. Is it the leaf having a trouble, or is there something going on with the tree, you know?
Yeah.
And And maybe that's one of the better analogies. Is
that's a good point.
Yeah, let's just
that's a
and
really
not
good
for
point.
Blame. You know, is there an outside influence? You know, you got we're struggling with, and I just remembered, by the way, I got to get a hold of the tree guy. But yeah, you know, if the leaves are you know, not during fall, but if they're, you know, middle summer, they're the edges are a certain way. We all know that it's not the leaf's fault. You know,
right.
There's something's going on with the tree and possibly deep into the roots. And mm-hmm. so can we approach it from that perspective, right? That it's not struggling, we are.
Yeah.
We are. And to take that idea of investigation instead of, you know, dictating or whatever that is, and really be willing to look and see what's going on, you know, and as a whole. Because if we can do that within a family system, then that obviously can expand out.
Sure.
You know?
Well, yeah, and there's another part to this, too, which is the intergenerational component.
Mm-hmm.
That's a whole other topic and a whole other issue, and we can, you know, mm-hmm. it would be a whole other show on that, literally. Mm-hmm. But the idea of knowing that this just didn't start with this family,
mm-hmm.
that there's a story before that got passed on,
mm-hmm.
and even though each family, you know, is different and separates, and some of them try to their best to change some of the dynamics that maybe happened in their parents' family and their grandparents' family and so on and so forth. Maybe, you know, there were different cycles, whether they be abuse or different forms of trauma. You know, there's this idea that, you know, again, wanting to hopefully have a healthy system.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, the picture's really becomes much bigger as we sort of move farther away and we get to see the extent of that. I mean, mm-hmm. I like the idea of the tree and the leaves, but that tree's really big when we look at all the factors and the dimensions mm-hmm. of this extended family and how things fit together. So,
yeah.
All right.
Well, that thanks for having me again. I mean, I don't want the last word. So that young man that
you
I spoke to.
You can have the last word.
It was interesting. And in the family topic, it was corporations are now adjusting to this new way of being. And so the consumerism, you know, this you got to work overtime, you know. And I can't say absolute or for certain, but by people that are in the industries, new, younger people coming in, they're so incredibly talented. And what's coming with them, though, is this idea of, you know, I'll get to work when I can, and I am not doing overtime, you know. And I think it's important to see the wisdom in that,
mm-hmm.
you know. And this is coming to the young man I spoke to. He said, I will never do overtime. He said, my father was never around.
Right.
He was a great man. He provided, but and once again, if you go just the opposite without, you might as well just work the overtime. If you're going to stay, I'm just going to do exactly opposite. You know, find that medium,
right.
you know, that works to support.
Moderation.
Yeah. And I just felt like that was important because there is a lot of wisdom coming from this generation where we see so much pain and suffering, you know, death, addiction. There's a lot of wisdom in there if we can let go that we know.
I agree with you. I think that's a really good point. There was a study that I saw just a couple days ago that millennials, mm-hmm. If you look at divorce rates as sort of a longitude study, millennial divorce rate is the lowest of any other group or generation within as long as they've been studying them.
Hmm.
Like they've gone down, it's dramatic. I don't know what the percentage is because I didn't read the whole thing, didn't look at the whole thing, but it was fascinating to hear that there's something that's changing within
right.
in this
it could
generation.
Be as well, once again, referring back to this young man, I'll get his name.
Of course, maybe they're just not getting married.
Billboard, give him credit. I'm gonna I've got his card. I'm gonna let him know about this podcast because it's important to get that voice in here. You know,
yeah.
We got two old guys talking about, you know, and
a couple old farts over here on the couch. Yeah.
Yeah, we think we might know, but he had his mother said, well, what do you think about getting married and kids? He said, I just don't know if I'm going to do it. You know, and this is based on having to go through a divorce himself.
Right.
Yeah. And so that might even play into, you know, they're succeeding because they're not as compulsive marriage that you have to get married. You know, they're actually choosing in a partnership. I think that's, and that's, once again, there's the wisdom. If we care to pay attention to that.
You know, that is a really good point. And there has been this shift. I mean, if we look even internationally, there has been in Europe for a while, especially Northern Europe, there have been these huge cultural shifts with the marriage rates going down dramatically. And and that's what I kind of threw in there. Well, maybe the marriage rates are going down with millennials too. I don't know. But I think that it is changing. The whole idea maybe of family systems is beginning to change. And this is, you're right. I think this is a good topic. We should get a couple millennials in here and have them explore this with us. So,
all right.
Let's do that next time.
We'll do it.
Okay.
Love you, man.
All right. Brett, thanks so much for being here today. We will, just a reminder of who we got coming up. I got Rebecca Holt next week. We got the Roundtable podcast the week after Dr. Simpson. And then I remembered who it was the last week of the month, Melanie Tackett, old friends of yours and mine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, can I, real quick, can I put in a, I'm going to give my number. So we're going through transformation. We're actually going to have a symbolic closing to have this new awakening and rebirth of the energy that's being created here by me and by others. And so we have different groups that are coming around, a men's social group work that we've been doing, possibly a co-ed group there, individual coaching and consulting. So I'm going to give out my number, Brett Heiner, 801-631-7122. And if you're interested in groups, some are recovery-based, some are not. It's based on some union training I've done. So if you're interested, give me a call. I'd love to talk to you.
Sounds perfect. And there are some meetings here now.
Oh,
you got Tuesday. You still got your aftercare, right? Yeah, Wednesday is refuge recovery.
Right.
Thursday is the family group.
Thursday's family group.
Family group, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and then Saturday the other refuge recovery meeting is
right
there as well.
Yeah. So if you're looking for groups, give me a call because we're going to be adding some too, and they are unique in a couple different ways, and yet we've held on to the traditional foundation as well. So
perfect.
Give me a call.
All right. Thanks, Brett. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week. Have a good week, and we'll go out as we always do with a little Joan Osborne. Adios.
Like, and would you want to see if seeing